All right, good evening, everyone. So glad you're all here. Want to recognize a few people for making this possible. As you know, Underground Institute is designed to be the extension of Underground Seminary's learning to be made accessible to our people. In particular, but to the general population at large who want to understand the Bible, as we believe that it was meant to be interpreted, and the world now, especially the last century. Laura is our chief architect again for this institute, and we've had incredible input also from John, who's done so much of the research for this, and Isaac, who has assisted us also in the research, and putting together all that we've been learning in our seminary to bring to bear to understand the world that we live in. So special thanks to these four. And also to our current crop of four students, Andrew and Brian John in the back, and John Janulis there, and Fidel, who is a member of Sanctuary Church, but is also part of our cohort, whose lively discussions every day also give us the kind of insight that we will bring tonight. So welcome to everyone, and we're so glad you're here. Laura wants to do a little exercise, and I'm going to be her scribe as she does that. Yes?
Yeah. just a few other things first. So again, we're doing 5 weeks. So our last institute was four, but this one will be 5 weeks. So we're going to be same time, same place. Emergency is again doing all of the cooking. Woo! So big job. So again, thank you for being here. And also, Rachel LeBlanc. I don't know if everyone's had a chance to meet Mark and Rachel. Where is Mark?
They're up upstairs.
They're just so helpful. They're everywhere. Rachel volunteered to do child care, so she's doing child care along with Paul, if more children come. So
just my kid.
Just if Rosie gets to be a handful, Paul and Moses will be upstairs helping as well.
Oh boy.
So thanks to those kids as well. We're asking a donation of whatever you can to help cover the cost of food and childcare and just putting this on. Suggested $50, but whatever you want to contribute is helpful, mm-hmm. And of course, whatever you can afford, even if that's nothing. So
that's only $10 for each session.
Whoa. A real
that's steal. A steal. Wow. Yeah, thou shalt not, yeah, anyway.
So our institute is on the economy and American economy, global economy, and how it is that we live in the world that we're in. And so what we're going to be doing over the next 5 weeks is really going back in time. And today we're going to do a really sweeping amount of history and just kind of background. And then starting next week, we're really going to go into the last 100 years of American history. Before we go back to the beginning and try to understand how we got where we are today, first want to kind of just ground ourselves in the reality that we live in right now, and start by naming some of the things that we see in the economy that we're a part of, the American economy that we're a part of. So what I want to do is just as a group kind of come up with some of the answer the question: what does our economy value, and what assumptions about reality does it make? So, do you think you'd write the question? Yeah. So the question is, what does our economy value, and what assumptions about reality does it make? And I'll give you an example. So one that I would say is that an assumption that our current economic system has is that the Earth has endless resources. Can you see that? I think maybe a different marker
can. Can you see that? What does our economy assume or value?
So the first one, we'll put the earth as endless resources. And then another one to give you a chance to think that I would add is that that the natural world is a resource. That's another assumption that I would write in that first one. So what are some others? Yeah.
You have to be producing to have value.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Infinite growth mentality.
Yep.
But endless resources.
So PJ, one was you have to be producing to have value.
Mm-hmm.
Another way you might say that, you can say the economy has to be growing.
Yeah.
Yeah. We hear that a lot. Like the economy grew by this much, or the economy is not growing.
More profit is always better.
Yeah, good
word. What was? What did you say?
The economy always has to be growing.
And what?
More profit is always better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like profit like older people.
Yep.
Mm.
Yeah.
Similar to what Mark said, but if you work hard, you will benefit in the second half.
Yeah. So again, what does our economy assume about reality and what does it value?
Time is money.
Time is money, good one.
Conversely from Lori, if you're not benefiting, it's your fault.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think competition is part of human nature.
Yeah. And a fundamental part of human nature, yeah.
It's a very complex system that's good for you.
Yeah, it's good for you.
May not always be true, but poverty is a sin.
Poverty is a sin.
Oh, that's good. I see we have a lot of sinners around here. Hey. Talk about our staff.
Wow. Wow. So we do. Disparity is good.
Disparity is good.
Disparity is good.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
Just having like huge differences between people who make a lot and people who make a little.
Uh-huh.
It's almost viewed as a motivational tool.
Yeah. Mm. I'd say another way of saying it is that there has to be winners and losers for the system to work.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm.
No tax for the rich people.
they earn it, right?
Well, if you make lots of money, you make up the rules.
If you make money, you make the rules.
I study economics, but what we learned is that actually the earth has limited resources, but desires are unlimited, right?
Mm.
So there's limited resources, but
the human desire is always wanting.
It's always wanting.
Okay.
Mm.
Did you get that? People
mm-hmm.
always want more.
Unlimited desire.
Yeah, like this is just the way it is. Like there is no other economic system.
Yep. This is it. This is inevitable.
Okay. So,
there's paper if you want to.
Capitalism as an inevitability.
There's a medium of exchange of values independent from relationships.
Say it again?
You mean, are you talking about money?
Yeah. Money means more than love? Is that?
Uh-huh.
I mean, yeah. There should be a medium of exchange like money that can be exchanged without relationships. Like, I mean, the assumption that, this money should be a convertible to another currency without much difficulty.
Yeah. Money as impersonal means of exchange.
Thank you.
The better you know, Kim.
I translate English.
I suppose even the idea that money is a thing as opposed to an illusion.
Mm. Mm.
It's a representation.
That money is real.
Mm-hmm.
Money is real like race is real. It's not, it's completely fake, but it has real effects.
I'd also add with the capitalism one that I think Lori mentioned, that any other system will lead to our destruction.
Mm.
Capitalism isn't perfect, but it's really the best way.
Mm.
Like, we were watching Mr. Robot. Has anyone seen Mr. Robot?
Yes.
It's a show where, like, some anarchist hackers just want to, well, watch it if you haven't. They want to hack into, like, the biggest corporation in the world and essentially cancel all debt.
Yes.
That's what their theory is, like, money is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gone.
Yeah.
The other ones. Interest rates? Just that, like, you know, when inflation, it kind of ties into growth, but this idea that you have to charge interest
mm-hmm.
for it to be a worthwhile
mm-hmm.
endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
Safety?
Yeah, like having to. Sorry.
Like, resources almost?
Sure,
like you have an abundance to make sure
you're going to be okay. Save for retirement, save a couple large surplus of money. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Money
to security?
Oh,
okay.
I have to admit, one of the things I've heard a lot lately is. Sort of a fatalist in the future. People may accept that the earth is not an endless resource, but it's sort of a we don't care.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very short-sighted view that
mm-hmm.
and they even use religious justification
mm-hmm.
for it. Some, I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, dispensationalism. Jesus coming back anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it seems far too common and not really based in faith, just
something that I internalized was that some countries are just meant to be poor. Like, some countries are just always going to be poor. It's just how it is.
Just like some individuals suck.
So, yeah. Also, really,
some individuals are rich and other individuals suck. Some nations are rich and other nations suck. That's capitalism.
All right, any more we want to add to the list before we move on?
It's a great list.
Private property, right? Only people have the right to own the land.
That's a natural right. To
mm-hmm. Right to private property.
One more that I would want to add is that doing good is a luxury and its own reward. So if you want to do good and that's what you want your life to be about, don't expect to make a living doing it.
Doing good is not profitable.
Or another way to say it is, or you might say, is financial reward is not, financial reward is not based on what a person contributes to society, usually the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Not always, but often the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Debt is good?
Well, so human virtue is divorced from any financial gain.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well,
okay.
That's good.
Yeah, a really good list. And so what we want to do is, the point of doing this is to raise to our awareness these things that are not, you probably didn't have someone teach you this, but you know, you've picked it up over time. Like, we all picked this up, that this is how the economy works or what it values. And so what we want to do now is to recognize that this is something that has been constructed. This set of values is not the way that the world has always been, and it is not the way that the world has to be. And so by naming some of this, we can see where we are right now. And what we're going to be doing in the next 5 weeks is figuring out how we got here, how we got to this set of values. So...
All right. Thank you. We have some chairs here. If you want to sit more comfortably than on the sides, if anybody wants to sit up here, you're most welcome to. All right. Also, special thanks to Church of All Nations for hosting the seminary, hosting the institute, and for being the community that makes all this possible. Okay, so let me say a prayer. Lord, thank you for gathering us tonight and for giving us this opportunity to learn about the world and to learn together as a community about your desire and design for us and how we might be equipped to understand but also to act in the world so that we can be a part of the movement of the Holy Spirit toward renewal and wholeness and healing of the world that we have broken so badly. Be with us, O Lord, and may your Spirit be present in this room and help us to open our hearts and minds that we might be converted to your way and transformed into genuine disciples. We pray these things in our beloved Lord Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so everybody have this handout? I'll just read this first part because I think it says it really succinctly. Every society enacts a script. And that means that we're all like actors in a story. And that script we also call scripture for those of us who believe that God has given us some instructions through the Bible. We live by a set of taken-for-granted assumptions about reality, the earth, and human nature. As Laura was mentioning, the air we breathe. Today, we are scripted by capitalism, an ideology that presumes that the earth is an inexhaustible resource and that the essence of human nature is self-interest and competition. Some of that we wrote on the whiteboard. Our basic operating assumption in this underground institute is that capitalism was birthed out of historical trauma. This unhealed trauma caused European peoples to dissociate from the earth, from communal life, even from their own bodies. The history of Europe is basically the history of war. Neoliberalism is an extreme version of capitalism, fueled by the growing power of corporations, the ideology that drives our present world, and thus our primary focus of this institute. We will learn what the religion of neoliberalism is, because it's definitely a faith-based system, where it comes from, and how it shapes us. We will track how the ruling elites colluded to detach the modern economy from the real world and intentionally obscure the sources of their economic power for their own enrichment. Which means that they obscure economic theory so much that no one can understand it. We will also examine how they employed sophisticated propaganda and used clever euphemisms like salvation, enlightenment, growth, and progress to hoodwink the masses. From local tribes long ago to city-states to nation-states to a world dominated by multinational corporations, we will survey the path that has led us into a way of life that is seductive yet destructive. Neoliberal capitalism may be the air we breathe, but that is not a given nor an inevitability. Everybody with me so far? All right. So how were things before capitalism, which is millions of years and certainly thousands, even since modern farming? We were semi-nomadic, hunting and gathering people. That was our lifestyle. And we did regenerative subsistence farming. That is to say that we grew perennial crops that were always there. Symbiotic relationship with nature. One of the upshots of that is human beings that produce no trash. Can you imagine a society with no trash because our human waste was just fertilizer for crops and our housing materials would just go back to the earth and be regenerative? So for most of our history, human beings, like the rest of creation, produced no trash. Think about that. And a gift economy that is not based on money, but sharing what we have and kind of keeping track in the back of our heads the way that family members do or should. I know that there are some families that keep exact tallies, and that's kind of weird, but a gift economy, oral tradition, where we pass on the story of who we are orally, matriarchal, meaning the societies were primarily governed by women, and the men did the work, but the women ordered the society, and organized in tribes, clans, and bands, relatively small groupings. So that's how kinship-based society was, where people were related to each other and did everything based on long-term relationships. The story of that is that human beings live within a community, and the community lives constructively within a bioregion. So they get used to the climate and the weather patterns and the kind of animals and plants that are available for food or for other purposes. And that bioregion that they're a part of is also part of a larger holistic creation. The spirit is present in and through all things. Everything and everybody is related. And so everything should be treated with respect. So it's not this hard like that which has a heart, a heartbeat or something, or that which seems to move. But if God is the creation of all, then God created rocks and trees and worms and human beings, then there is to be respect for everything that God has made. That was how kinship-based societies understood it, and that was what they meant by spirit. And persons were rewarded when they care for the earth, care for one another, and live sustainably. We were talking about how there's very little reward for doing good. You know, there's basically a complete divorce between virtue and earning a living in today's society. In fact, you make more money if you're unvirtuous in many situations. That's a crazy messed up society that we've created when we have such perverse incentives. And we've talked a lot about this ancient story in our Bible Institute for those of you who were able to participate there. So we don't want to spend too much time there. But any questions about how ancient societies were? And let's not forget that there are some societies still like that that we have not molested. Okay, so let's then jump ahead to 3000 BCE or 5000 years ago. So this is a period of roughly 4,650 years. Intensive agriculture and concentrated settlements set off a cascading effect of greater control of food supply on one hand and growing incompatibility with nature on the other. Increasing alienation from nature means intensifying conflict among humans who now try to control life and death. What we're trying to say here is that as people got better and better at farming, right, they were able to control the food supply. And then they also got better at storing food. And if you can grow more food and then store food better and make it last longer, then you have actually more control over life and death. If you think about just strictly living off hunting and gathering, if you have abundance for a season or even for several years, you might have, you know, excess weight that you don't need, that and you could be have a lot of protein, you could be relatively healthy, and then you might have some lean years because of the weather patterns, and then you might be drawing from your own fat supply, right? I mean, like people ate as much as they could in the bountiful times because they knew that they were going to be lean times. But if the lean time got really lean, longer than was sustainable, then people died. So people lived and died with nature, basically. But once human beings got better and better at food production and food storage, then we have a little bit more control over life and death, right? And then instead of just living and dying with nature, once we go against nature to control life and death a little more, then what happens is that we start competing with each other as human beings to control life and death so that I have more control over life and death than my competitors, my neighbors. So before that, before the advent of modern agriculture, people just lived and died naturally, literally naturally, with nature. Okay. Got the logic? So surplus agriculture and the ensuing division of labor, because surplus agriculture means now instead of everybody trying to just hunt and gather or do farming to eat, some people can be full-time soldiers. Some people can be full-time priests. Some people can be full-time accountants, you know, keeping track. Some people need to start to read and write so that they can keep a tally of the surplus. And so it leads to specialization. And this, so that's what we mean by the ensuing division of labor, encourages some to increase power over others, primarily in the form of city-states. So powerful cities ruled by kings, priests, scribes, and soldiers. So we have the first city mentioned in the Bible, the son of Cain, Enoch, is that right? And then later we see powerful city-states like Sodom and Gomorrah, right? A city-state is kind of a centralized ruler that controls a city, and that city controls the surrounding food supply, that the extent of its control over the surrounding countryside for food coming to the city depends on the power and scope of that city. But it's a new development in human civilization. So city-state is the basic leap into human civilization, civitas, the city. And then there's a list of some developments, irrigation projects, storage of surplus crops, population growth, and other things that we list there. Slavery, certainly. So the story that is told in this Western city-state empires, and we say Western not because we're not unaware that the city-state empires began in the ancient Near East, in the Fertile Crescent, but because there's a continuous line from the empire, the city-state empires of the Fertile Crescent right into Europe to the present day. The story that was told to justify these oppressive city-state empires was primarily through religion. The ruling class claimed that the source of this new power is God. They say that the sacred is now housed in the temple and more generally within city walls, while chaos and disorder exist in the wilderness beyond. Right? Before, people lived in harmony with nature. Now, nature is seen as chaotic, at best, evil at worst, outside the protection of the city walls. Plato, a philosopher around 400 BCE in ancient Greece, provides the most convincing rationale for coercive power in his idea of dualism. Dualism means two different things. The immaterial or disembodied spirit, mind, or world of the forms that he imagined to be existing, a perfect world of the forms where everything perfect exists in an alternate abstract universe. Versus the material world, which he thought was fallen. So everything that we can feel or experience through our five senses, the material world, he believed, was evil. Reality is ordered through a great chain of being. God on top, then angels, then the king and the aristocracy, then free male citizens, then women, then slaves and children, then the savage pagans beyond the city gates, then animals, then plants, then minerals, in this hierarchy of being. Civilization is growing more complex and sophisticated, leaving more primitive ways behind. The centralized city-state is peddled as good news for all, even if people need to be converted by conquest. This theology, or this view, that God has given the ruling class special authority to rule over everybody else, is the primary ideological tool used to justify city-states. So religion, if we were to use it with a small r, before this period, was just a sense that God and God's spirit pervaded the natural world and that human beings were part of God's creation. Later, God is seen as one who's housed in the temple within the city walls, and that outside the city is not God or chaos. And that when we worship God, then that means we entrust those that God has appointed to be our leaders, the ruling elite, kings and such to rule over us. So even though we're oppressed by them, they also save us from the chaos outside the city walls. Right? Does that make sense? So this is what we also call institutional religion as an ideology to control the masses. Basically, religion is propaganda, becomes propaganda in this period.
I was going to point out this image is an actual painting from the time period depicting this hierarchy of value with God on top and then rocks and dirt down at the bottom. It's kind of hard to see, but you can at least see the layers.
So this is supposed to be God, angels, king here, aristocracy, free male citizens, women, slaves, children, pagans, plants and animals here, rocks, dirt, minerals here. So the hierarchy of being, or the great chain of being.
This is in the Fertile Crescent, or where was this?
It comes after Plato, but then Plato's ideas, and then especially in the Middle Ages.
All right, so the next page, we're going to now talk about the economy. Economics as a discipline first originates with the Greek philosopher Xenophon, who is contemporaneous with Plato. And he considered oikonomikos to be the art of household management, from the Greek oikos, meaning house, and nomos, management. He later expanded that to include the whole city-state, the management of the city-state. So city-states morphed into empires that grew through resource extraction, such as tithes, taxes, and tribute. But unlike today, this was not justified by the need for economic growth. There was no justification based on economic growth. The new regime simply claimed that God ordained them with power to organize the household economy, including the household of the city-state. So instead of just managing life, right, it became a kind of an art or a discipline in this time.
You could say this, it's kind of confusing with how we think of it today, but there's actually no separate thing called an economy this time. It's not a, like we have today.
Right.
It's just integrated with everything else as a part of overall.
Thank you. And so there was some resistance to this whole scheme, right? Because you really have to believe that, you have to believe all this, that the centralized city-state ruled by a few powerful people is good, and that everything outside the city walls is evil or chaotic, right? That takes a kind of a faith. So there was some resistance. The early Israelites defected from the city-states of their time and returned to kinship-based village life in the Palestinian highlands, practicing subsistence agriculture, redistributing resources, and following Yahweh, the God who called them out of Egyptian slavery. So coming out of Egyptian Empire is one of those stories, but even Lot and his daughters coming out of Sodom and Gomorrah is another example. The destruction of the Tower of Babel is another example of God calling the people into kinship-based society, kinship-based economy, rather than the centralized city-state, walled off. This little tradition, meaning kinship-based society, the little tradition inspired the prophets, Jesus, the Apostle Paul, the Desert Fathers in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries, and many other faithful to embark on similar movements in their times. They focused on challenging exploitative power arrangements while renewing kinship ties and returning to village life. Elsewhere, in areas of the world not yet touched by centralizing empire, tribal and village ways of life remain the norm. Today, there are just tiny little pockets. We can count them in the hundreds, at thousands at the most, of people that are still trying to live in this way.
Trying to live this way because they have been, because they haven't been encroached yet.
Right, or they have...
even exists. They have had minimal outside costs.
Right, because the resource extraction is not worth the effort, right?
Right.
And so they've gone further and further into the jungle, or higher and higher into the mountain, or you know, into the deserts, or just they've learned to survive in the most remote places now. So ideological collapse. This whole way of thinking collapses, this whole arrangement. The way of Jesus was co-opted by Constantine in the Edict of Milan in 313, where he made Christianity legal. But he didn't just make it legal, he made it the ideological foundation for the new Roman Empire, or he tried to renew the Roman Empire through Christianity, and formed a new theological justification for empire and called it Christendom. Christendom simply means the domain of Christ, Christen domain. Rome was sacked by the Huns in 410 and officially came to an end in 476, but its legacy of the imperial city-state continued in the Eastern Byzantine Empire, Constantinople, for 1,000 years in the east, what is now Istanbul, and later in the Holy Roman Empire, which is Central Europe from Germany to kind of northern Italy. This led to crusades, first against Muslims, but you know, crusades also happen among Christians, and to new methods of wealth extraction, especially like the selling of indulgences, and the abuses of that, which led to the Reformation. The Reformation resulted in multiple competing church-state alliances that led to a flurry of devastating religious wars across Europe. Known as the 30 Years' War, from 1618 to 1648, it effectively ended the long era of religion as a primary method of coercing the masses. So religion was the primary way to convince people that they need to stay in their place, right, of slavery or poverty or oppression. But there were so many competing religions. Well, when we say religions, we mean Christian religions. Catholicism, Lutheranism, Calvinism, Anabaptism, and others. And there, so many people died. Roughly the same percentage of people in Europe died in these 30 years as during the bubonic plague 300 years before. That's how catastrophic it was. And Europeans were just so, those who survived, fed up with the religious wars that they moved into a new era, which we will talk about next. Bentley.
So Constantine kind of started the whole idea of using Christ as a way to control people. He coined it, I guess?
I would describe it as Constantine was the first major ruler to co-opt the Christian faith into imperial rule. So he made Christianity the ideology of the Roman Empire. Prior to Constantine, Roman paganism, which was a variation on Greek mythology, so like the Greek Zeus became the Roman Jupiter, right? So Greek mythology, Roman paganism was the way. And Constantine, some people don't know this, Constantine was also the pagan high priest of the Roman Empire and never relinquished that title until his final day. And right at his deathbed, he got baptized, and he was considered an unbaptized Christian for most of his rule, but he was both a Christian and a pagan high priest throughout his life. And he felt because the empire was already beginning to deteriorate, and that's why he moved the Roman imperial city, the capital, from Rome to a new city that he founded. It was called Byzantium, but he called it Constantinople after himself, and shifted the center of imperial power to the east, but used Christianity as the ideology for empire, basically. And the Western Church has not divorced the early Christian way, the way of Jesus, which, remember, Jesus was crucified by the Roman Empire. Christianity has been Constantinian Christianity in the West, or imperial Christianity, for the last 1,700 years. The West has not really done the early church Christianity, except in small pockets, like the Desert Fathers, or monasticism, or mysticism, or like Anabaptists, who try to do the little tradition the best they could. But the preponderance of Western Christianity has been Constantinian imperial Christianity, meaning faith plus money and power allied together. And if we know anything about the New Testament, we know that those things did not go together in Jesus' ministry. Right?
I'll just say, so if you look again at the heading, the story of progress, Act 1, religion and Western city-state empire, that time period, 3000 BCE to 1648 CE, that's a huge period of time. And so the point is, there was religion throughout this time period, and one kind of religion or another was always being used to prop this up, to prop this way of being. And eventually that became Christianity. Christianity started as a response to all this, a saying no to all of this, an alternative. But again, really got co-opted into just another version of the same thing. And so what this time period has in common is that as using religion as a way to get people to buy into this. Until in Europe, they just had so many religious wars, were killing each other. They're like, okay, we're done with religion. This is not working anymore. This is not, you know, this is not working out. And so when we focus on Europe, because or the West, because they are the ones responsible for our global economy as it exists today. But that's what the collapse is. Just, you know, like Pastor Jim said, endless religious war when finally enough is enough.
Mm-hmm. So the 30 years war is hard to describe how utterly disastrous and devastating those 30 years were. And I dare anyone to try to understand the 30 years war. Alliances shifted all the time. It's broadly Protestant versus Catholic, but Protestants sometimes allied with Catholics and Catholics with Protestants if they had a rival that they thought was a greater threat. The if you just looked at the color of the map of the alliances in those 30 years, it's just changing constantly. And you never knew if your allies were going to be your enemies that killed you the next day. So it wasn't just endless wars, it was just endless anxiety. And René Descartes, the most important Enlightenment philosopher, came out of that period and was himself so devastated, psychologically devastated by that period, that he said, let's go Plato and go into abstraction. Plato himself is a product of the Peloponnesian War, where the war between Athens and Sparta caused unbelievable amounts of death and maiming and misery. And you see, out of the trauma of that kind of war, Plato imagines an abstract world of the forms, perfection. Right? And out of the devastation of the 30 Years' War, Descartes pulls Plato back into play and says, I think, therefore I am. The only thing real is whatever I imagine it to be as a pure subject. So now we're ready to move into...
Just going to point out on the back, there is a timeline of some of the events that we're talking about. So in case you're, there's a reference to a lot of historical events, and if you're not a history person, here's a kind of a cheat sheet of what's happening when.
Mm-hmm. So like I just mentioned the Peloponnesian War. There it is, 431 to 404. Plato comes of age right in that period. One of the things that we do at Church of All Nations and how we interpret both the Bible and world history in Underground Seminary is through psychology. Like, what are people actually going through? So that philosophy and all of that is ultimately working out our psychology. I mean, we should not be fooled into thinking that philosophy is its own standalone discipline. That is a Western mind trick, people. All right? So, the story of progress, Act 2, Reason and European Nation-State Empires, from 1648 to 1945, 300-year period. The nation-state includes all the elements of the city-state listed above, but connects the polity of the state, meaning its system of governance, with the cultural identity of a nation. Remember that in the 30 Years' War, people were not that loyal to the nation. I mean, France was emerging as a first kind of nation where people are loyal to France as a kind of a geographic area. But most people were loyal to the Roman Catholic way or the Reformed way or the Lutheran way, things like that. Now the nation state is emerging as a real power as opposed to organization around religion. It is defined by its borders, restricts who can be a citizen, controls imports and exports, determines the language, etc. Rather than loyalty based on religion, the nation state encourages nationalism. Right? Loyalty to nation, not loyalty to religious affiliation. Wars will now be a competition among nations rather than among religions. This is a major, major shift in the mid-1600s. The modern nation state is only 300 some years old. Okay? It's a very recent phenomenon. What is the story, the subtext? The innovators of this age claim that the true source of power is reason, right? Not religion, but reason. And they still say, they all say they still believe in God, right? That's the funny thing about these guys. I suspect that they really don't, but the Inquisition is still happening. So you just say you believe in God, but the real thrust is reason. Beginning with the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, the treaty that ended the 30 Years' War, European people begin to shift from religious superstition toward enlightenment. So enlightenment is the opposite of religion. Do we understand that? The guiding ideology is Descartes' dualism. The individual knowing male, yes, male mind, just like Plato, is a subject endowed with spirit, abstract. While the body, the actual community of people, and the earth are objects devoid of spirit. The supremacy of the rational mind allows for objective scientific analysis and experimentation and results in a scouring of the globe for resources and labor, from the transatlantic slave trade to the Berlin Conference in which European nations carve up Africa into colonies. In 1884, European nations gather in Berlin with the U.S. as an observer, and they decide how they're going to carve up Africa with no African representation. Isn't that convenient? And that's basically the national borders we have in Africa largely come from the Berlin Conference of 1884. Just crazy. Can you imagine if a bunch of Asian people met in Seoul and just carved up Europe the way we wanted to? You know? Anyway, one can dream. All right. So, mind over matter means the cultivated European mind over the mindless bodies and resources of the earth, right? Those who are not thinking about domination are primitive. Trees are not thinking about domination, so trees are primitive. And indigenous people are primitive. So the advanced people, right, the cultivated people, the mind over matter people, need to dominate all the primitive people and things in the rest of the world. That's the logic. This racist, materialist ideology is the foundation for the Industrial Revolution and capitalism. If all is an object, then objects can be commodified and extracted for energy, bodies commodified for free or cheap labor, and goods commodified for money, capital. Commodity means that which is indistinguishable from another like thing. Like, grain is a commodity, right? And cattle is a commodity because there's not really a distinction between one cow and another when they're all going to be slaughtered for meat. Now, we think that human beings are special and unique, but actually in capitalism, human beings are also a commodity. We're just labor input for material output. Get it? And that's why Western capitalist societies are inherently so dehumanizing, because we get a sense that our companies will replace us just like that if somebody will do the same labor for a slightly cheaper wage, right? Or if there's a machine or computer program that can replace us. So when we are that replaceable, and even companies that we've worked for decades, I've heard of this, places where people have worked for decades, they're fired without any advance notice and given 1 hour to pack up all their stuff. 20 years of coffee mugs and photo albums and photo, you know, whatever, that they have on their desk. They're given 1 hour, and they have a security guard there so that that person doesn't make a scene, right? When you're treated like that, after 20 years of service, you're a commodity. So bodies commodified for free or cheap labor. Of course, slavery is the ultimate commodification of the human body. In this social Darwinism, meaning the fittest should rise to the top, humanity is turned upside down. No concern for being humane with one another. Barbaric cruelty is considered more evolved, advanced, while cooperative community is considered less evolved, primitive. Get that? Basically, Western civilization is the glorification of barbarism. Is that, anybody object to that claim? Because I'd love to hear a historical rebuttal to that claim. I mean, this is just based on history. If by their fruits ye shall know them, then that's basically the fruit of Western civilization. Is barbarism euphemized as the height of civilization? So then, what's the economic basis for this new story, for this new era, the age of reason? Adam Smith, in 1776, same year as the Declaration of Independence across the Atlantic, understood economics to be a science and no longer an art. It's no longer about managing one's household, whether a family or a city-state. It is now a science that advances the national interest. He regrounded economics from management of the national household to a discipline based on universal law. He taught that the nation can increase its wealth best if it moves away from feudalism, which is about land as a source of wealth, to refounding the economy on the division and specialization of labor, commodification of human bodies for labor. John Stuart Mill, in the mid-1800s, sought to uncover the laws of human nature and apply them to economics. Okay? Did you hear that? Laws of human nature. He concluded that people are primarily motivated by the desire to possess wealth and by their love of luxury. He basically said that is a law of human nature. He assumed people are fundamentally individualistic, self-interested, competitive, and calculating. Law. Economic theory increasingly became a science unto itself, separated from the earth and the common good. At this time, economics is not yet driving the dominant narrative, but developing a new scientific authority as a standalone discipline. Now it really becomes a discipline worthy of its own academic department in universities, right? So John Stuart Mill put forth a law of human nature where basically he said, at our core, we are greedy and selfish, competitive and calculating. Now, I would say, based on my pastoral ministry, based on my pastoral counseling, that people who are individualistic, self-interested, competitive, and calculating are people who have unhealed trauma. That is the effect of trauma. That is not human nature. As we said, European history is a history of unrelenting war and violence and exploitation. What kind of philosophy are we going to get from people with unmitigated trauma in their bodies? Questions about the discipline of economy as it emerges from Adam Smith to John Stuart Mill. Yes.
What you're referring to about like John Stuart Mill and the laws of human nature perhaps also shaped some of the theology around original sin that came out of that same time period. That we are inherently as human beings selfish, greedy. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious.
That notion of human beings as fallen is very much rooted in Christianity being co-opted by the Roman Empire, right? And it comes out strong again during the High Middle Ages with the scholastic theology that put us in some kind of divine court where God was a judge and we were criminals, basically. And Jesus had to pay our fine, pay our stay in prison by dying for us so that we can be set free. That came out in the 1100s to 1400s. And then the Reformation, when the Protestant reformers came about, they fundamentally did not change that notion that we were horrible human beings, depraved, you know, totally depraved sinners in need of God's grace. What John Stuart Mill did was take that notion and make that human nature, move it, shift it from the realm of theology into a new economic discipline. The laws of human nature that is now a foundation for economic theory based on how human beings are going to behave. So I think theology came first and then economics. But our modern understanding of humanity, I think, is largely now informed by both theology and political economics. So that's a double whammy, right? As if religion wasn't bad enough for our self-esteem. We got economics telling us we're all horrible human beings as well.
But it makes it a virtue.
How so?
Well, Adam Smith, not to the same degree, but certainly for John Stuart Mill. I mean, selfishness now, self-interest, is what drives the economy.
Yes, it's virtuous for the economy.
Yes, for the economy. And what's most important in reality, I mean, especially as we get to the neoliberal period, is economic growth. So by the time we get to full-blown neoliberalism, this sort of self-interest and competitiveness is absolutely a virtue.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Adam Smith talked about the invisible hand of the economy. If everybody acts out of their natural self-interest, the economy will grow. The modern economies, modern Western capitalist economies are obsessed with growth. So in the U.S., for instance, the sweet spot is somewhere between 3% and 4% GDP growth per year, gross domestic product. Why at least 3%? Because below that, you're hardly keeping up with inflation, the natural rise in prices. And at 3%, you stimulate jobs. More jobs means more income, means more houses and cars and toasters and everything, and that increases the wealth of the nation collectively. But why not really more than 4%? Because if GDP grows beyond 4%, you can stimulate inflation. And then money is the money supply grows faster than the actual productivity of the economy. And then you have money that's worth less and less as time goes on. Remember the hyperinflation of Germany after World War I, where people had wheelbarrows of cash that couldn't even buy a loaf of bread? So if you have too fast GDP growth, then you can trigger inflation, higher than you want inflation. And if it's not fast enough, then you have stagnation, right? So what is the ideal GDP growth target between stagnation and inflation? In the U.S. for decades now, economists have said roughly 3 to 4%. So if we were like 3.6% GDP growth in a year, that would be like, I mean, that would be the dream, right? But that assumes that human beings have unlimited greed. Imagine if we said, this house is big enough. This car is good enough. I mean, we would stop having unlimited growth. So our obsession with GDP growth year after year assumes that we have unlimited greed and that we will never be satisfied with what we have with just constructive human relations, but we're constantly calculating and hoarding and acting like jerks, basically. So, I mean, our entire economic system assumes that we're all jerks.
Can I just connect a couple of things here?
Mm-hmm. Please.
We started with Descartes. So Descartes' writing out of the context of, he's actually writing in the mid-1620s, right in the heart, and he's French, he's writing right in the heart of the war. He actually writes his Meditations as if it's a dream or a nightmare. And he's trying to figure out what is authoritative now that the church has failed. and scripture is not authoritative, nothing's authoritative. All he can come up with is his knowing mind. It's the only thing he can figure out that's real with all the devastation around. So the result of that, of his theory, is that everything else exists as an object, and everything else is separate. Nothing's related anymore. Everything's an object. All that is real is the mind. So this brings us then, of course, to the scientific revolution, and it brings us to industrialization. Now we can do experiments. Now we can do whatever we want to anything. And it leads to technology and quote-unquote progress. But it's because there's no assumption of spirit in anything anymore. So, and the Industrial Revolution in Britain is at the same time as Adam Smith is coming up with his theory. He also assumes that everything is just set apart, separate. And so his understanding of economics that starts to develop, he's not as bad as those who come after him. They really just extract stuff from what he says. But this understanding that things can just now be commodities, including human beings, laborers, all goes back to this sense of separateness. This everything is just matter or things. That goes back to Descartes. Descartes comes up with that in the midst of total warfare out of trauma, a nightmare. So Descartes' nightmare, read some of that text. It actually is just the narrating of a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Leads to this nightmare, leads to an economic theory or system that assumes everything is ultimately just matter slave.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, we can live without a car. We cannot live without water. And what we are doing to our water supply, what we're doing to the oceans, the very source of our survival, is crazy. But I deal with that kind of crazy as a pastoral counselor. Like, I deal with people occasionally who cut themselves. Anybody know people who cut themselves? That's kind of, more extreme. But have you ever eaten a whole carton of ice cream by yourself? Okay. Have you eaten, like, a whole pizza, greasy pizza, all by yourself? That's really self-destructive, right? We know that. But we need to cope somehow. When we're really, really stressed and we need to cope, we'll do things like that. So we have all kinds of eating disorders in this country. We have all kinds of people that are cutting their own bodies and harming themselves. That means that they are not associated with their body. There's a detachment. There's a dissociation. This earth is our home. Dissociation with our own body is going to lead to dissociation with the earth. And no group of people on the earth are more dissociated from matter, like their material self, more than average white Americans, even more than Europeans. So we have the single most dissociated population to ever emerge on the face of the earth. And hopefully some other people in the world will stop us from destroying ourselves and the earth that we live on. But basically, Western economics comes out of Western philosophy, which comes out of Western theology, and all of it is based on trauma from war, and then trauma that leads to dissociation with ourselves, our bodies, our relationships, and the earth itself. We have an economic system, a political economic system, that's basically based on traumatized dissociation. That's the fundamental point here. So we'll just do a couple of more things, and then we'll take a break and then do some Q&A. So there's resistance and alternatives to this in this era too. Industrialization and capitalism create unprecedented wealth for the capitalist ruling class, but miserable conditions for slaves, indentured servants, and lower class factory workers. There are numerous slave rebellions and anti-colonial movements in Asia, Africa, and the Americas. Revolution and protests break out across Europe in 1848. That was the first major European-wide revolution, with many reacting to the miserable and exploitative conditions of industrial factory work in the cities. Alternative communities sprout up in the 19th century across the U.S. even. Shakers, Oneida Community, New Harmony are examples, as a reaction to a growing sense of alienation. Socialism emerges as a viable political and economic alternative in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and by the early 1910s, socialism becomes a serious political force across the world, including in the U.S. So we really downplay the rise of socialism in this time, but it was a major global force. Also in the 20th century, The Bruderhof would be another example of alternative communities sprouting up as a reaction to this. And then the ideological collapse, the collapse of reason as the major animating idea of this industrialized era. The European capitalist nation-state brought an end to religious wars, but created a new tension, fast-growing industrial economies and a scramble for land and resources across the world. The advent of reason, science, and technology were proof, quote-unquote, of European supremacy and progress, which justified colonization of the rest of the world. This culminated in an arms race with European nations forming mutual defense alliances. Okay, think about Spain as the first nation using an Italian guy to exploit the New World. What does Spain do with that? It gets rich super fast, but also it builds the Spanish Armada. And then Spain takes over a part of the Netherlands, right? And then Spain also, through marriage alliances and other ways, you know, controls major parts of the Holy Roman Empire. So the Netherlands are not happy with Spain's rise because they're a colony now. France is greatly threatened by Spain. Great Britain is greatly threatened by Spain. So then now the Netherlands want to go to the New World and exploit gold and silver and timber and slaves. Then Great Britain wants to do that. France wants to do that because they need to keep Spanish power in check. So when does Great Britain become the global empire that eclipses Spain? What happens? Yes, remember the Spanish British War, where the British Armada sinks the vast majority of the Spanish Armada? The storm. Well, yes, they got lucky. But anyway, the Spanish Armada is destroyed. And how does Great Britain build that kind of naval fleet with resources and money from the New World, right? So much of the utter misery that Western nations create all over the world is because they are afraid of each other. And they are trying to do a balance of power with each other at the rest of the world's expense. So if you're the Netherlands, a little tiny country in the lowlands of Europe, it makes sense for you to go out and exploit whatever you can to defend yourself against Spain. But my question is, why are Europeans so crazy violent? You know, why couldn't they just kind of get along? If Europeans got along, the rest of the world could have been left alone, right? Just endless wars. It didn't make any difference whether Europeans were pagan or Christian or Protestant. It just never seems to make a difference with European Western civilization. Just endless wars and then spreading it all over the world. So this, as I said, culminated in an arms race. The result was World War I, which was primarily about boundaries, colonies, and spheres of influence, and its continuation in World War II. Get this, Germany and England are the centers of the Enlightenment, the Academy, high culture, and industrialization for 200 years. And yet they were bitter enemies and the opposing centers of these wars that devastated Europe. England was primarily Church of England, Henry VIII. Germany was primarily Lutheran, Martin Luther. And yet they were the bitterest enemies for centuries. They drew the entire globe into their warfare due to the reach of colonization. Furthermore, nationalism led to right-wing fascism in Italy, Germany, and Spain. Germany, perhaps the most rational country and the very center of Western civilization, succumbed to Hitler and the Holocaust. Enlightenment, reason, and illusions of progress were shattered in Europe, only to continue in a new form in the United States of America. So in 1648, religion as the driving ideological force of Europe ends, or begins to end, 1648. 1945, reason as the dominant idea that undergirds nationalism ends in Europe. So Europe enters into a postmodern phase after World War II. But the United States only enters postmodernism in the late 20th century because we've taken on the mantle of European imperial supremacy. And we say, well, where Napoleon failed, where Hitler failed, where the British Empire failed, we will succeed. So the United States is an empire not only in our political, economic, and cultural reach, but in our idea, our self-understanding, we are an empire, unlike any country in Europe today. Right? No country in Europe sees itself as an empire today. Maybe Russia, but basically the U.S. is the only truly Western nation that sees itself that way. And that's why the United States is so dangerous, right? Germany, even today, would be far more dangerous than it is if it saw itself as an empire. All right, let's take a 7-minute break and then come back for some dialogue. Let us gather. All right, I'm really proud of this typology that we came up with. So to as a review of the different time periods, you know, we kind of gave roughly the time periods. So kinship-based society here, kinship-based society with a tribe clan is really ancient. That's our human origin, basically. So there, the polity, or how they governed themselves, was as a tribe and clan. And how they did economy or sharing of resources is through a gift economy. And their ideology or the story that they told themselves of who they were is that they are part of the spirit of God's creation. And that God's spirit was in everything. And their anthropology, which means their understanding of humanity, how they understood the meaning of being human, was kinship. That all are related to each other, that we're all relatives, and therefore we should treat each other with decency and respect. But with the city-state, a new polity emerged, where people separated themselves or segregated themselves from nature. And the intensive agriculture and food surplus and storage made it possible for people to live in cities and have other people outside the cities do the food cultivation and people inside the city to live off that. And then they now no longer did economy as a gift, but as management, like controlling who got what. And then their ideology was formal or institutional religion, where they said a few of us get to rule and a few of us get to have a lot because God ordained us to be the rulers, and we're protecting you from the evil of the natural world, the chaos of the natural world. And then what it meant to be a human being was to be subjects, servants or slaves of the rulers, right? The vast majority of people now were subjects rather than relatives. And then we move into the nation state at the end of the 30 Years' War. So 1648, the Treaty of Westphalia basically brings an emergence of nation states where they are not going to be organized around religion or the city-state like the Roman Empire, right, which is a huge city-state, but the nation-state with national borders, and their economy is going to be mercantilism, which is the export of goods to bring in national wealth. So there's some exchange of goods and services within the domestic economy, but how do you increase exports as much as possible? So you bring in raw materials, you finish it through the industrial process, then you sell it for export and enrich the nation at the expense of other nations who must be a consumer nation as opposed to a producer nation. Right now, we have European nations like Germany, that's still largely mercantilist in its approach. China is the best example now of this mercantilist approach, where they have a centralized economic system and it's designed for national economic growth at the expense of other nations. The U.S. was like that too at one point. And its ideology was reason. And reason, science, technology are all related, right? And it gave people the illusion that humanity was progressing toward greater and greater mastery over the earth's resources, over the primitive, including other people that were in less primitive, more primitive societies. And then the anthropology there is that the human being is a citizen of the nation state whose goal was to be a productive member of that society, to contribute to the national wealth and national well-being. And also, now that wars are fought along nation state lines, you have to support your nation state if you don't want to get annihilated by a competing nation state, right? So if you're British, yes, you might be against war because of your religious convictions, but you should nevertheless support the nation state, because if not, the Germans will annihilate you with their V1 and V2 bombs and maybe nuclear weapons. So then now, and this is where we're going to spend... And now, the next 4 Wednesdays are going to be spent in this column, okay? The corporate state. And if you think about where we are as a country, our major corporations control our polity. They buy our politicians. And they determine our laws, whether it's taxes or tariffs, our health care, family leave policies, educational policy, everything under the sun. Corporations basically buy out our politicians. So we have these massive multi-billion dollar corporations all over the world, and they are largely controlling governments now everywhere. And that kind of economy is called neoliberalism, which is extreme capitalism, where it's not about it's not like mercantilism, where you are organizing corporations and the economy for the nation state, but it's the nation state now that uses its national laws and other mechanisms to support corporations. So the nation state is in the service of the corporation rather than the corporation in the service of the nation state. And then the ideology is economics. So now the high priest of the corporate state is the economist, right? Remember Alan Greenspan? He was effectively the high priest of our American nation state for 20 plus years, right? Whatever he said, it was like the Oracle at Delphi. And then our anthropology, how we see ourselves as human beings, is that we see ourselves as consumers. There's hardly any mention of Americans as citizens anymore. We're mostly referred to as consumers. So here, kinship, in order to do kinship, you need to be an adult, right? It takes a lot of maturity to do kinship, to relate to people in a constructive way over a lifetime. Here, you're a child, a subject. After the devastation of religious wars, people are told that they are adults again. You're now citizens. You're responsible and productive members of our society that has to build up the nation state, right? Everything, all of this builds up the nation state. But then in the corporate state, we're children again. We just suck at the breast of the neoliberal empire. And all we're supposed to do is just consume, 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 just like infants do, right? So how did we get here? How did we all get brainwashed into thinking that corporations are all powerful and that they should control our life? That neoliberalism, which assumes that human beings are greedy and selfish as heck, is the economic system that we should govern ourselves under, that economics is the religion of our modern life, and that we're nothing but suckling infant consumers all our days, right? So the next 4 Wednesdays we're going to focus on this. And that means that we'll start next week with the wars, and especially World War II, and the Bretton Woods arrangement that gives us the World Bank.
That would be week three.
Week three. But eventually we're going to get to the Bretton Woods arrangement where FDR and Winston Churchill and Stalin met. Was Stalin there? Anyway, and they came up with international institutions like the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, IMF, GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which eventually becomes the WTO, World Trade Organization. The international institutions at the governmental level that basically institutes neoliberal economics for the whole world. So that's our, that's kind of a review of our lesson today. All right, anything else from you guys?
I think I would just really point out here that, I mean, tribe, clan, that section is kind of separate, but city, state, nation, state, corporate state, that when it comes to the dominant ideology, religion, reason, economics, there's a way of looking at it where it's just one and the same thing, but it's just a different sort of justification. But the structure remains the same, and the structure goes back to Plato. I mean, you can look at it in terms of dualism. So religion here is extremely abstract, imperial religion, and it serves the king. Reason, I mean, what is reason? Reason is actually quite abstract as well in the way that it's formulated in the modern era, and it serves the nation state. Economics, in the way it's formulated in neoliberalism, is extremely abstract. It's a made-up world. It's a world where a human being is simply a calculating man. Like, it reduces a human being to just self-interest, calculation, desire to consume. It's a totally fictional character. And then it creates an entire philosophy out of this made-up fictional character that is separated and divorced from the earth. So all of this, the religion, reason, economics, it's actually just the same thing, mm-hmm. just told in different ways.
Right.
And that is an other idealized world of abstraction that justifies domination in various forms.
Yep. And that's why Laura put a hard red line here, because this is just basically one evolving system. Right. This is one whole system that kind of takes on new names and new manifestations. This is the old thing. And our assumption at Church of All Nations is that Jesus came to restore the Jewish people to this way, to a tribal, clan, family-based polity, to a gift economy of sharing, of giving to one another. And the Apostle Paul in the Roman imperial context, trying to translate this in the cities of Rome, Jesus trying to bring spirit. And what does Jesus say? That when I leave, I give you something even better, the spirit, the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit is a spirit of kinship here, right? That we're all related. And that's why Jesus said, we are even to love our enemies. Does that make any sense in this framework, to love enemies? That makes no sense. Loving enemies only makes sense in this column. Love your neighbors, love your enemies. Because all are related, because we're all kin, because God is the one creator of us all. And in that way, Church of All Nations is distinct from many other churches that are based here. And assume all this as a given, as good, and even as an inevitability. No way, no how. The only way we could believe that this is good or a given or an inevitability is if we don't believe in Jesus, in my opinion, the real Jesus, who was crucified because he stood for these things. Why would the Roman Empire, built on this, crucify Jesus if Jesus were this? This is the system of the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the scribes. This was Jesus. All right. Comments? Lori.
So do you think it's like a progression away from, like, tribal clan? Like, is it harder to get back to a tribe clan from nation state than it was city state? Is it even harder to get back to tribe clan from corporate state? Is it progression away? do you think, or no?
I personally think we get more and more into abstraction the further we go there. Because even like a nation state has some borders in the real world. I mean, what the heck is a corporate state? What is a corporation? It's I mean, so many levels of abstraction away from actual lived reality. And the goals of a corporation, you know, crazy. At first, you just make something and you sell it to people. But later on, when it gets big enough, who knows what a corporation is about? Becky?
Theology is like the propaganda.
Yes. Yep. We actually put theology first, because theology means God talk. Theo logos, God talk. Because I think like economics is our true religion now, our true theology now, right? But we didn't want to use, because that word is also used within the Christian tradition, so we used ideology instead. But yes, ideology, propaganda, the theology of the day.
But our goal primarily isn't necessarily to understand these different philosophies so much as to live the way Jesus wants us.
Right.
And that you can, depending on what tribe, clan you're in, that can be just as difficult as living in a corporate state.
Right.
In a corporation state. So it's not like we're going to change the whole world back to any other state. Our goal...
There'll be a fifth one, which will be hopefully more amenable to the sorts of relationships that existed in the first one.
Yeah.
Right, but there, I mean, and, there's tribes and clans that where it's definitely not the way Jesus would have had it, when women are treated like property. I mean, right.
It's a hyper-simplification of the idea.
Yes.
Of a clan. There's been millions of different tribes, different
exceptions, of course.
Human relationships.
Absolutely.
All haven't had kinship as their base anthropology.
Right.
They all haven't used spirit as their base ideology. You know, mm-hmm. what he is explaining to me, at least, is the idealization of
yes.
Jesus wanted for that
well
specific
said.
Tribe or clan.
Well said.
Because, I mean...
Yes, it's to live it. So I just two things. I appreciate what Nick just said. A typology is inherently simplistic, which means it doesn't really reflect actual reality. But a typology can help clarify our understanding so that we can interpret the world better. If we don't have a typology, like for instance, male-female is a typology. And there's actually some gray areas if you know, actually look at biology, like how some people actually are born. But in general, it helps us to categorize, you know, our daily life. Adult-child. There's a gray area between adult and child. And some of us are always in it. But anyway... But generally, to have an adult-child typology can help us navigate the world. So I totally agree this is simplistic. There are exceptions to every one of these things.
You could say that nation-states, corporate states are a bit fuzzy.
Yes, it is fuzzy. There's fuzziness here. There's fuzziness here. There's also fuzziness here because some tribe clans evolve into a city-state while maintaining some tribal aspects. But to Daryl's point,
ancient Athens, the Greeks were kind of working out the tensions from being tribe clan versus city state,
right.
Trying to reconcile that.
It takes hundreds of years sometimes for something to evolve from one to the next, right? So this is not historically accurate as much as it's conceptually can be helpful to sort things out. To Daryl's point, it's true that how we live is the ultimate thing, but I also remember Jesus' pedagogy, meaning how he taught. He said, "You have heard it said, but I say unto you." By Jesus making a contrast, it helped people to live into what Jesus was teaching more clearly by Jesus saying no to this and yes to something else. So yes, we want people to live into this, but we also want people to say no to these things, because if you look at that chart, we've mostly been saying yes to this whole thing. So when we keep saying yes to that and then also say yes to this, it doesn't make sense. We have to say a clear no to certain things in order to say yes to the way of Jesus. John?
Yeah, and just as far as following Jesus, absolutely. The challenge is Jesus is always connected to one of these ideologies throughout history.
Right.
So spelling out what that ideology is to try to make Jesus distinct from that and try to read that story anew knowing what Jesus is not. Because there's a lot of neoliberal Jesus out there right now.
Definitely.
So we want to make clear that that's not what we're saying.
As Depeche Mode once said, your own personal Jesus. That's what Jesus becomes in an individualistic society. Everyone's own personal mascot.
Would you say it's almost a prosperity gospel?
That too. If you want Jesus to be the source of your prosperity, then that too. Keith?
One thing I find interesting in this is that as you see a progression in time, you often see a half-measure attempt at moving backwards. Mm. Turn this clock. There's a
some reform movement.
There's a feeling in a lot of us, and I think in almost all of us, that this is not right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a nebulous feeling that God puts in us that this is not right. Mm-hmm. That's mental constant battle mm-hmm. that happens that breaks us down because we realize that what we're living up to is not even the right thing to be living up to. I find like a lot of times conservatives wanting to go back part ways. They want to go back from corporation to nation, or they want to go back to religion being the dominant force.
Right, here. Mm-hmm.
You know, from reason. That
right.
Big movement in America for
right.
a long time.
That's right.
But they don't want to go all the way back to spirit.
Right.
That's too
radical.
Freeing. Too radical. So the biggest thing to think of in terms of this whole class, I think, one of the biggest things is no half measures. We're talking about moving back to back to the Jesus model or discovering what that model is and how it looks like today.
Right.
I mean, it might not be because obviously we're not going to be hunter-gatherers. I don't see that happening. I'm not a big fan mm-hmm. of hunting. I'm not a hunter. And
we'll have our own tribe, bro.
And I certainly don't have a green thumb.
Yeah.
But I can't support sustainable local agriculture. Mm-hmm. Again, there are ways to look at it in our context. But the idea of being in my mind is always trying to get back to the base, the
right.
origin, and never part ways, because that's almost more mm-hmm. more damaging.
I mean, it's very difficult to undo a national and international economy based on this now, right? All the way back to this. But we can actually do this and this in smaller ways.
Yes.
So, and if enough people do these things, we can possibly even extend the gift economy that we practice here to in very small ways, you know, further and further. And that's why I hope people here get to talk to Mark and Rachel LeBlanc, who are from the Spring Valley Bruderhof community in Pennsylvania. Would you believe that they do not handle money at all? Whatever they need, they go to the procurement person and say, I need a pair of jeans or I need a pair of work boots, and they just get it for you. If it doesn't fit, you ask again. You know, but there's no money exchange. The only time that they use money is when they come out of the community and stay, you know, with other people like us. Then they get a credit card, a community credit card, and a community car, which they borrowed here. But they own nothing. It's this completely, you know, shared purse. And they're taken care of cradle to grave if they commit to the community for life. But they're actually living based on a gift economy by having a couple of businesses that the community owns collectively, but all the profit goes to the community and not to any particular member. So this is a really weird thing, but it's actually possible.
Do you think that we are not only ruining the earth, but we are ruining our own bodies?
Yes.
Because we are taking so much chemicals.
Yep.
We are using it, we're just with it. So this is movement compared to, you know, mm-hmm. the fundamental idea of going back.
Right.
That I think there's a, you know, we have to embrace the earth, and then also we have to make us aware
mm-hmm.
that we should really prevent
yes.
children to not to keep ruining the
body. Right. You know, Minnesota rivers are some of the most polluted in the country because of farm runoff. And then Minnesota is responsible for a third of the dead zone south of the New Orleans in the Gulf of Mexico. The runoff from Minnesota that goes all the way down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. I bet that if we did some kind of a chemical picture of our rivers and all the pollution there, and did a chemical photograph of our bloodstream, that the level of pollution would be pretty similar. I mean, there is so much pollution in our own bloodstream. So yes, we're killing the earth and we're killing ourselves at the same time. Josiah.
This may be a question that reveals how reason, how much of that is in me right now, but what about the, advances in medicine, some of the benefits of this advance? And I think you commented at the very beginning about how we just live and die with nature. I'm assuming based on, isn't it better to live than to die with the seasons? Or I guess I'm just curious. Mm-hmm.
I'll just say one thing and then feel free to jump in. About life and death. We actually had a real good discussion of that yesterday as we were planning for today. But about technology, ancient peoples have used technology always, whether it was the wheel or the bow and arrow. I mean, that's a very sophisticated technology, bow and arrow, compared to just like a spear, for instance, or a spear is an advance. Where technology is okay is when a population is sustainable in the bioregion. Right? The bioregion must be able to sustain that population size without the population turning on each other and killing each other for limited resources. That's when you have overpopulation. So when a population group lives sustainably in a nonviolent way with its bioregion, then you have the right size. And if technology helps you expand the population in a nonviolent way, then technology is great. What we have now is we're killing ourselves, killing the earth, and we have technology that helps to mitigate that to some degree. I mean, like all this advanced medical technology, for instance, is basically mitigating, softening the ways we're killing and poisoning ourselves. So the bigger advance would be for us to eat non-poisonous food, like laced with chemicals and runoffs and hormones and crazy plastic stuff. You know, like, do you know how much plastic the average American consumes? Stuff that melts in the microwave, stuff that comes out of the dishwasher. I mean, like, we have a lot of plastic inside our bloodstream, right? And when we drink tap water, how much, I don't know why Americans dump pills into the toilet, but that's kind of an American habit. And all that wastewater gets recycled in our plants. And a lot of those chemicals in our drugs come back to us, right? So the bigger thing, the bigger advance would be if we ate more natural, healthier food rather than ingesting junk and then having high technology mitigate that effect, right? So I'm for technology, and I believe that technology is going to be one of the critical pieces to moving us toward greater humanity. You know, technology got us into the mess. Technology is going to have to get us out of it to some degree. But it is definitely not the solution because it hasn't been in and of itself. It's only a tool. I mean, the way that we're destroying ourselves, our bodies, and the earth we live in, there's no amount of technology that can even come close to solving the mass destruction that we're inflicting. Just last comment, somebody who hasn't spoken, maybe.
Pastor Jim, do you see other alliances and other churches
that are doing similar things, even locally, that, you know, where we can find some even cross-communal, like, engagement with. I mean, I really love what we're doing, but I also love to see it, like, be broader than just our local
community. I mean, I wish so, too. Unfortunately, I mean, you know, I've been in the Twin Cities for 18 years now. We're going to ally ourselves with anybody that's moving us in the right direction, right? So even incremental steps in a constructive way, we're going to ally with. But in terms of, like, really imagining a polity, economy, ideology, anthropology that is really whole and constructive, wholesome and humane, there's not that many churches out there that have this kind of radical vision and hope that we can do this. At best, it's mitigating the effects of the corporate state. You know, how do we make our corporate state less harmful to our people? So again, we're for that. But to get us to this thing, there's very few. There are some churches and some movements and some organizations and some individuals all over the country, all over the world, of course, and we have been informed by them. We've learned from them. They are mentors to us. But many of us are basically isolated in wherever we are. There's precious few connections that we can even make because you can almost count those of us who read the Bible this way and interpret the world this way, you know, in a few hundred, really. Yeah, and they're actually living it without having this analysis, because the Bruderhof was formed in Germany in 1920. So they're approaching their 100th anniversary. They're just kind of living this way, and they're not free from everything either. But so we can learn from that, right?
I would say, too, there are probably communities that might have one, but not all of those aspects.
Yes, good point.
There are communities that do get the economy very well, but they might not, you know, be living as kin or, you know, guided by a logic of a spirit. They might be guided by reason or religion, kind of more of a formal way. So I think as much as we can learn from communities that are doing one of them well, it might be a fun place to start.
And how many of you have used a church vehicle to move something from here to there? You know, like, it's ridiculous that regular people in a church would own a pickup truck, because pickup trucks are highly inefficient. But if a church has one pickup truck, for instance, and is shared among its members, how much more responsible is that in terms of the use of the Earth's resources? And in sharing, and us all contributing to one pickup truck or one, you know, SUV, for instance, and doing that. So a lot of churches won't do things like that because insurance reasons or whatever, risk. But we're just taking baby steps in this church. But we're really trying to do that more and more and share what we have. By the way, think about what we do by our meals together on Sunday morning. If we don't do that, I mean, it's not likely that a lot of us go home at noon or 12:30 in the afternoon and all of a sudden cook a whole lunch for ourselves or for our families after spending the morning in a worship service. So most people will eat out. Think about how much money we save. Think about also how much we save our bodies from the harmful effects of eating out. Even you know, non-fast food restaurants are still worse for our bodies than home-cooked meals. So even little things that like that we do in our church, there's a reason for that. As with the tiny, tiny baby steps that we take, we're doing as everything that we can to move into this area for our people, not only because we believe that it's healthy for us, but because we really believe that that's what Jesus was trying to do, bring humanity, health, and wholeness back to the people. And the Roman Empire would have none of it. And the Jewish leadership that got its power by allying itself with the Roman Empire also would have none of it, because then their hypocrisy would be exposed. So that's why he was killed.
Just add to that, you know, we put ideological collapse on each section here. This gets us ahead a bit, but I just want us to start thinking about it, is that the corporate state, we ideological collapse can take a long period of time before the thing actually like dies, and then it, like this idea carries on in different pockets. But we are in a period right now where there is ideological collapse happening. I mean, Trump is actually a symptom of that in one way, or a reaction to that, or whatever. But there's others who are reacting differently. And I do think, as far as like connecting with people, they're not all going to be in the church, but people get that, and they're trying to rethink and move back to something closer to spirit and to kinship. You know, there are pockets of people all over the place that are wrestling with this, thinking about this, reorganizing. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen in the church a lot because the church is connected to some of these other things.
Right.
Religion, yeah, or reason, yeah, if you're a mainline liberal or whatever. But,
or being a good American citizen.
Yeah, or mega church and the neoliberal thing. So, I mean, it's like you get caught up in these other areas in the church. So I think this period of ideological collapse is a period of tremendous opportunity. And that's where I think there's a lot of opportunity to rethink human life, rethink social organization, rethink polity, rethink economy, all of those things, because of where we are right now, and there's an opening and there's a space for it. It's kind of a scary time because things are crazy, but that's a lot of the hope that I feel right now. You know, like when the Roman Empire fell, we just talked about the Dark Ages. It actually opened up tremendous, tremendous space for people just to return to village life again.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a liberation for a lot of people for some period of time. You know, when things start to collapse like that, there is space to go back to humanity again. So I think the church has a place in that.
Amen. Well, thank you all for being here, and I hope you'll all come back next Wednesday as we move more and more to the present. Again, thanks to Church of All Nations, our wonderful church, for making something like this possible. We have wonderful leaders in this church, and elders like Nancy and others who believe in this kind of vision and are moving us toward health and healing and wholeness, as I said. So since I mentioned Nancy, would you say a closing prayer for us?
Dear God, thank you for your leading and your guiding and your care for your people. And I pray that our hearts will be open to your spirit, to your teaching, to your truth. Help us to live out the way, and live the way that Jesus wants us to.
Amen. Amen. Thank you all.